So much to story of my life. Can we go around and remind me of names a little bit? Because you know how dumb I am and I forget names from year to year and some people I don't know already. I'm Beth. Okay?
Jeffrey.
Hi.
Greg.
Yeah.
Randy.
Yeah. Hi.
Bus. I'm Andy.
Hi.
Brit. Howard.
Ron.
Auntie. Okay. Usually by the time I get here, I've given whatever talk is I'm given a couple of times already. But this is going to be the first time, and it's going to be a little clumsy, if not a lot clumsy. So... first, does someone have a watch so I can, and tell me what time I have to be stopped by in order to have time for questions. So we're at 7:30 now, and we're going to stop completely at what time?
8, or okay. Leave time for questions.
Okay, so I should talk about 20 minutes-ish. The topic this year is gratitude under fire. All right? And for those of you who know me, whenever the topic sounds like it might be cheerful, like if it were just gratitude, you know there's going to be a lot of gloom and doom around. And the question is, what is the value, what is the relevance of the teachings when things are hard? Because the Buddha tells us he taught two things. Taught suffering and the path out of suffering. And the path out of suffering has no meaning if suffering has no meaning. Okay? So... I want to first talk about that piece of gratitude that's really, really, really fun and really foundational. And I want to talk about my first experience of it in 1980. And I want all of you to think about your own experiences of it. At that point, I was in retreat in a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful Zen center on the Hudson. And I've been working on fear. And something broke. And I went outside and I was sitting under a tree pulling weeds, because it was work period after all. I mean, we're Zennies, we work. And the air was so luminous. And the green of the grass. And the sky. And the colors of the bark of the tree. Everything was filled with such luminous grace. And for the first time in my life, I understood what gratitude was. It's being filled with that luminosity. And having it flow from us. There's a form of Japanese psychotherapy where they put you in a room and what you do is you think of all of the many kind things that people and animals and the universe have done that you haven't had to work to deserve. You know? The air, the water, your mother's breast milk, you know? All these things that have been given us, and you dwell on them, and as you do, your heart opens, and the energy flows from the heart compassionately towards all beings. So that's kind of, that's the, that's what it looks like when it's really pretty, huh? Okay. But what about when our lives are hard? What about when we've lost our job, or we've lost our house, or our kids just finished college with $80,000 worth of debt and no job, and we don't know what we're going to do about having co-signed their loans, or our spouse leaves us, or I'll get to Cambodian examples in a while, but the problem is no different, you know? There's tremendous, tremendous, tremendous suffering going on in America right now. People who've worked all of their lives to have some stability and have had it vanish overnight. You know, people who have placed hope in positive change and seen that betrayed. You know, you don't have to go to Cambodia. You know. Even those who are personally exempt from it, everybody knows somebody. You know, the homeless are no longer just the people in the streets in Palo Alto. They're our friends. You know, 40% of children in the United States are malnourished. Okay. Food banks are empty. Yeah. You live with this. You know this. You see this. Many of you work to help alleviate these conditions. Okay. Gratitude? Are you nuts? Am I nuts? Whatever gratitude is about, it's not about denying the reality of the suffering that's going on around us. It's not about taking some kind of Pollyanna view of the world and saying those things don't matter. That's indifference, that's not gratitude. And that's poisonous. Okay. But the work of keeping our hearts open in ways that strengthen our compassion, and with our compassion, our ability to do sometimes the very, very tiny things that may help a little depends on, in part, on our clarity of vision about the suffering, and in part on our willingness to let grace, and especially the grace of gratitude, be foundational in our lives. So I'm going to tell you two little Cambodia stories. Both of them sad. Then I'm going to tell you a little bit about how horrible it's gotten this year. And then I want us to look together at what on earth use gratitude is when this is going on. Okay, as most of you know, I run a small project in Cambodia working with destitute AIDS patients. Our primary work is chaplaincy. We do some social work, mostly referrals, and in the last few years, our material aid programs have gotten much larger. We now feed more than 50 multidrug-resistant tuberculosis patients every week and every month. We feed 110 prisoners with tuberculosis and AIDS in the prisons. We provide transportation money to get medicines for more than 200 people. And we take on all kinds of weird cases as they come up, the things that fall between the cracks. But our primary work is chaplaincy. Our primary work, as many of you heard me say a million times, is to help people get it that the Buddha's compassion is already present right in the middle of their suffering. That being poor, having AIDS, having uncontrolled diarrhea and being unable to help yourself in the middle of it. You know, I'm using a particularly unpleasant example so that we are sure we're not sentimentalizing. All these things are why the Buddha taught. The Buddha didn't have to teach. The Buddha taught because we have suffering, right? Okay, well, we got suffering. And if we pretend we don't have suffering, then, you know, whatever we're going to do, it's not going to be studying the teachings. It's not going to be realizing the teachings. It's not going to be getting the benefit of the teachings. And it took me a long time to realize. Because when I started Zen, I thought, okay, you start with suffering and you move to liberation, yeah? Well, no. The road to liberation goes through happiness. And until we can develop a peaceful and compassionate and even joyous heart in the midst of suffering, then the possibility of liberation isn't yet born in us. It's born in us because we have it as our birthright, but the practical possibility of liberation. And finding joy in the middle of suffering is completely and totally different from rejoicing in suffering. I mean, I trust that all of you understand that thoroughly. Okay. So, one of my staff, one of my very, 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 very magnificent staff is a woman named Soon, who seven out of ten of us have AIDS, all right? I'm one of the three who don't. Soon has it. She's almost died repeatedly from tuberculosis. She has a tremendous heart, and her gift for Reiki is unbelievable. I mean, I have two people. I'm a pretty good Reiki practitioner and a decent teacher. But I got two people who are really outstanding. And she's one of them. And there used to be times when, you know, Sin would be seeing a patient and she'd be somewhere else and I'd go to see the patient and the patient would say, "Why isn't Sin coming?" And I'd be real hurt. Now I not only expect it, but I've learned to rejoice in that, because for a teacher, there's nothing better than to have your student excel you. You know, that's really where the action is. And my staff are Khmer, and they're working from inside. And most of them have AIDS, and they are really working from inside. And we picked them because they've got these incredible capacities for compassion inside. So if they're not better than me, I'm not doing my job. Anyway, Sun's very close friend of many years developed stomach cancer and spent a month dying with great difficulty in the Marino Hospice. And we've just reached a point where when something like that is going on, when someone is that close and one of our staff really knows them, we don't care, okay? That person can spend the whole of their working time with the person. And we will manage around that. Okay? So Sun was spending 3 and 4 and 5 hours a day with this woman for weeks. And then the Mary Knoll Hospice decided to close, which is part of my joyous stories for this year. But I had gone down with another staff member to talk to the head of the hospice to get the actual story about the closing. So I stopped to see the woman. And her belly was like this, and the rest of her was like toothpicks. And she could not find a position where she could lie comfortably. And I started working with her feet, which were hugely swollen. And Ramon, my translator, was working with her back and with the energies in the back of her neck. And so we're doing Reiki, and we're doing Reiki for about half an hour, and it's okay. It's okay. I mean, she gets it that we love her. And then Sun arrived, and we went in to talk with the head of the hospice to find out what was going on. Right? And when we were finished, you know, we took another look into the room, because she kept saying, Quintilla kept saying, I just want to go to sleep. I just want to go to sleep. So she'd get in a position, and then 2 minutes later, she'd be uncomfortable, and And when we first came in, she said, the staff is mad at me because of the diarrhea. And, you know, so we sort of sorted out her diapers and wiped her off a bunch and did that part of it so that she didn't feel so humiliated. But she still couldn't get comfortable and couldn't get comfortable and couldn't get comfortable. So she'd move, and then we'd move where we were working with her. And anyway, after the interview, we came back, and I looked in for a minute, and Sun had put a blanket on her and was sitting by her head chanting the precepts. You know, in Cambodia, when you're dying, you get the precepts, right? You get them again and again and again and again and again. It's one of the things, the protections that people get as they go. So Sun has got her hands on her head and on her shoulders and is chanting the precepts in this very gentle, very beautiful voice. And the room is filled with peace. And Ramo goes in and join her, and I go and do what I have to do next. And they stay there. And at some point, they realize that Quintilla had stopped breathing a bit ago. But she went so seamlessly and so peacefully that they didn't even know when she went. Okay. I am so grateful to have people working with me who are capable of providing that kind of support. I am so grateful that Quintilla went with so much peace. I am so grateful for Sun. But Sun has been walking around since. I mean, she's exhausted, of course. But she looks like a bride. There is a radiance about her that is just extraordinary. This beauty is made possible by seeing clearly where the suffering is. And this beauty is the fundamental source of our strength to continue the work. When we lose sight when we lose hope, when we lose love, then it's very, very, very hard to do the work we do. And all of our training, all of our Dhamma training, all of our practical training, all of our work training is designed to support, in this sense, in this context, our sense of gratitude. Because to be able to be with someone in those moments is a tremendous privilege. And to be able to be there and to be the intimacy of that, just to be able to experience the intimacy of that is worth a lifetime of effort. Now, I say this, and today I've been grieving all day. I had a favorite bad boy prisoner. Those of you who read my monthly letters have heard about him. We've known him for about 3 years. He looked like a Khmer Humphrey Bogart in The African Queen. Tremendous energy, tremendous vitality, really smart, okay? And all of that bad boy charm. I was very, very grateful I was an old lady by the time I met him. And he's had what's been basically undiagnosed stomach tuberculosis, or at least they thought so. And he'd been in the prison ward for a while. And he was getting sicker and sicker, and he couldn't hold anything down. And the diarrhea was getting out of control. And the prison guards were really good with us. There are certain hours you're allowed to visit, but they let us in all the time. They let his kids stay with him. He lost his wife about 10 years ago. She came from, I think, an upper social class, because the photograph of their wedding in Battambang, which is in north of Phnom Penh by a couple of hundred kilometers, looks like a wedding photo out of The Godfather. There's this big mansion and this big family in gorgeous clothes. And he knew he was going, and last week he said to me that he knew and that he wasn't afraid, and I believed him because he had tremendous courage. Been a soldier most of his life in some of the most dangerous areas in Cambodia. His body was filled with protective tattoos. Everybody's got protective tattoos, but his were just gorgeous. He got them in the far north where people really know how to do those things. So you've got all this Pali writing and a huge necklace of Pali writing and some going down his belly and across his back and more going on his arms. And then beautiful, beautiful. I wanted to photograph it, but the photographs he had of himself were when he was healthy and when he was happy. And I didn't want to take pictures of him in the condition he was in and have him feel disheartened. All right? So the doctors told him he needed blood, and we had no way to do it. We have a couple of donors, but one of them just had a bad heart thing herself and was in the hospital, and the other had given blood within 2 weeks. So we couldn't. And I have a strict rule about my staff because we get requests for blood all the time. And I have only 2 people they'll take it from because they won't take it from me. So I saw the chat a couple of times during the week, and the fear was starting to get to him. You know, he wanted the blood. You know. And what I saw was that this was about fear of dying that he couldn't admit to. And it made me reflect a bit about the difference between courage and equanimity. He had tremendous, tremendous courage, but he'd never had the foundations to develop equanimity. And then on my way to the airport on Friday, I stopped in and saw him one more time and, you know, kissed him goodbye and, you know, told him I wanted him to wait till I got back. But he died Tuesday at noon, and I just found out this morning. And I wanted to send Sun to take care of him over the weekend, because mostly we send men to the prisoner's room, right? But it was beyond the point where it would be a problem. But I wasn't going to put Sun into that situation again when she wasn't even 2 weeks past her friend dying. So the men saw him. They saw him every day, and they spent good time with him, and they did lots of Reiki and lots of chant. He didn't want chanting, and he didn't want precepts. The short version is the Cambodian government has thrown the major NGOs working in AIDS out of the country so it could steal the millions of dollars for itself. And overnight, systems that have taken 10 years to build and have been working really, really well have collapsed. The government sends supplies, syringes, medicine, etc., to the hospital. The hospital sells them to the pharmacy, and the pharmacy sells them to the patient. So all this basic stuff you're supposed to get for free costs. In Cosamac Hospital, where the organization left on August 31st, there was no food last week. Now they've got an arrangement where they'll give you uncooked rice and a little bit of money, but if you have nobody to cook for you, the budget for food in the prisons and the hospitals, it's the same, is less than 25 cents a day, and you're lucky if you get it. So the death rates are going up. Our ability to help is radically diminished. We've had to set a limit on the number of prisoners we can see. We've had to set a limit on the number of people we can provide transportation for from out of state, mostly because we don't have the staff to do that work. My donor who gives me money for the prisons would give me more money, but we'd have to go twice a month, and we don't have the people to go twice a month. It's things like that. And we're lucky because we can still see 110 people. The Nanaimo Hospice was a refuge for dying people long before antiretrovirals came in. Very simply structured. It later it got more sophisticated. But it started out as a simple place of kindness. And the people who founded that program and the person who was running the program are both now in the States, and the people who took over are facing both the lack of money in the Catholic Church right now for reasons we all understand, but that they are not guilty of, and staff who have no interest really in AIDS. So what money they have, they want to turn into taking care of the orphans they've taken responsibility for and making sure that they get an education and grow up. So the hospice is closing. And five of my staff owe their lives to the hospice. So it's really traumatic for them. You know, it's really traumatic. So we are seeing what we can do about that, and we don't know yet. But there's a turning that it's possible to do in the mind that liberates us from the burden of this knowledge and allows us to absorb this knowledge and continue to have the strength to work. There are a number of such turnings, but the one I want to talk about right now is gratitude. We are tremendously grateful that for 11 years we had the Mary Knoll Hospice, that so many thousands of people are alive because of them. And the moment that you do that shift, it's not a shift that says, oh, it's okay, the hospice is closed. It's not okay, the hospice is closing. It really, really, really is not okay. All right? It's not okay when your husband loses his job, or your wife loses his her job, or you're one payment behind on your mortgage and all of a sudden you're homeless. It is not okay. And it's ridiculous to pretend it's okay. And Buddhism is not about telling yourself lies. But it is possible to identify those tiny spaces in the middle of it where there are things of beauty and to allow the gratitude that flows from that recognition to give us the strength to continue the work of our own liberation, to continue the work of our compassionate commitment to the suffering in the world. And above all, to be grateful for gratitude itself and for the power that it has to transform our capacity to work with suffering and to help us move toward joy in the face of it. When we just started and we used to go out, this was before the missionary sisters kicked us out as heathens, we'd go out to the missionary sisters and what they'd say to us, the kids who were dying there, is, we love it when you come because you make us laugh. I thought, boy, that's weird. And, you know, 11 years on, I get it. That the opportunity for joy, the opportunity for gratitude, these things which strengthen us, are tremendously, tremendously important. And especially when things are bad, you know. And it's not that I'm grateful that I'm escaping it. I'm grateful I still have a job even though so-and-so doesn't. It's not that one either, okay? It's not the, you know, I mean, we can feel lucky to escape some of the terrible things. But that's not the gratitude we're talking about. The gratitude we're talking about is the gratitude that sees the possibility of transformation, the possibility of beauty, and the fullness of compassion, even in the midst of the most terrible conditions. Thank you. Okay, well, I talked too long, but we have time for a couple of questions. Up to you guys. It's 8:02.
Well, I was wondering, since we have some goodies and things, if some people need to leave, now we'd like you all to stay and ask questions, but if you need to leave for some reason, you could.
Okay.
Well, I don't think we need to close,
okay,
but we can continue this.
I would prefer we not try to talk about this over cookies.
Okay.
I'm in love with the cookies and all that.
Okay.
And we can have lots of conversation over it, and people who need to leave should, but it's real hard sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just see what kind of questions there may be, and then, is that okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Did I get you all so depressed nobody wants to ask anything?
Since you sit with a lot of dying people, and you talked about how what a gift it is to be with a person as they pass away, do you observe after the... do you have certain practices that you observe after death? You just sit with them as long as you can?
Okay, one of my resentments is I don't get to do that so much anymore, because my job is to make sure that my staff gets to do that. That's one of the reasons I was really unhappy to leave Vichette, because if I hadn't been flying on Friday, I would have been able to be there Saturday and Sunday. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, that's answering me for me personally. For us, we give precepts, we chant, we continue to chant until the person has gone. You know, in Cambodia, traditionally, the moment you stop breathing, they, like, pull you out of there, right? But they don't do that with us anymore, pretty much. I mean, the Tibetans say 20 minutes, and our experience is that's actually about the range. You know that the person is gone, that they're not there. So we try not to disturb anything and to chant during that time. We keep a list of the dead on the altar. Major precept days, when we go to the Russian hospital mortuary where we put a Buddha and we clean it and we chant, the first thing we do is take precepts, and everyone who's within their 49-day period takes precepts with us. We privately do a lot. I've been doing metta for Vichette for 4 days now. I was doing Reiki for him first, and now I'm doing metta. You know, because the Tibetans say that in that period, right after death, and the Cambodians also, that's a tremendously powerful period for change. Because you're free from the constraints. You know, they talk about the five niyamas. There's the laws of physics, there's the laws of heredity, there's the laws of the way the human mind is constructed, there's karma, and there's everything else that are relations of cause and effect, right? Well, when you've left your body, what's there is karma, is the causes and conditions of moral intention. And they're free from any of the constraints of time and space and history. So, and the Catholics actually are very much like this about purgatory. Purgatory is where you could really help people. You know, the bardo is where the power of your kind intentions work only in the moral intentional space of the other person's, you know. The rest is gone. So we respect that a lot. I respect that a lot, you know. All of us take it for granted and work with it a lot. We give precepts. You know, the precepts are what protect us. So we give lots and lots of precepts. My staff usually gives 5 because they worry about people eating at night. I always give 8 because by the time we're giving them, we don't have to worry about their eating at night. And even if they do, it doesn't matter. But we give precepts again and again and again. We chant again and again. Every Wednesday when we do Dhamma study, we dedicate the merits. Whoever else we're dedicating the merits to, the newly dead on the altar are actively included. What we do personally at the moment of death and afterwards, it partly depends on where they are. We are. I mean, one of the things that hurt my staff on Tuesday is they came to see Vichet. He had just died. The rule is that you cannot be cremated from the hospital. They have to take you back to the prison. And then you go to your cremation from the prison. And they would not let my staff in to chant because the police were there going through the bureaucracy of that. And that made my staff really, really, really unhappy. And so what I've instructed them to do, if we can, is to go to his mother's house, to give her the money for the 7-day ceremony and to give them some money from me personally. And then 100 days after his death, which is the next time that there's usually a formal ceremony, I'll be back and we can all go. So it varies a lot. Sometimes we sit there forever. Sometimes we go, you know. But what we always do is chanting and precepts and metta. Thank you. Okay. Yeah? Yes?
Well, my first observation at this, when you're dealing with dying people, is pain management. What are you doing about pain management?
We are not the doctors. Okay? Some of these hospitals, Palliatives Without Borders was running a place at one of the big hospitals. They've been thrown out by the government, and now they've been reduced from 30 to 15 beds. What we do about pain management directly is we do Reiki. We do healing touch. We do massage. You know, we are not the medical staff, and it is very important that we do not come into conflict with the medical staff, however corrupt they are, because we are guests in the places we go. One of the things I saw with Vichet that I hadn't seen in years at this hospital, when we started working in this hospital, half the IVs that were put in wrong, and the liquid would go into the tissue and people's arms would swell. And we'd go and we'd get the nurse, and sometimes the nurse would come and sometimes the nurse wouldn't come. And after we'd done it a few times, nobody came. Yeah. what we do about pain management is the emotional and spiritual side of it. That's what we do about it. If we open a hospice, you know, then we will have more control over direct pain management, right? But under the conditions in which we work, you know, all we can do is get ourselves thrown out of the hospital by doctors and nurses who are angry because we caught them not doing their jobs. Sorry. Two years ago, 2008, I would have told you that the National AIDS Hospital in Cambodia was arguably the best regional hospital for AIDS. Medicine Sans Frontières had built the staff, they provided the medicines, they had the supervision. They were really accustomed to working with Cambodian poor, so they knew what works and what didn't. You know, the doctors' salaries were supplemented and MSF made sure they weren't, like, getting money on the side from the patients. Now it's a hellhole. We had a patient there. I'm trying not to tell you too many of these stories, and I'll shut up if you want. But she got diagnosed with her AIDS very, very, very late. And she was a drug addict, so we took her to the organization that works with drug addicts, and she ran away. And she was still selling herself on the streets, and she wound up in the hospital. Okay? But the hospitals are not taking any new patients for antiretroviral treatment anymore. The two places that were still taking patients have closed down. So she was in the National AIDS Hospital, but she was officially registered for antiretroviral medicines at another hospital. Okay, and she started having horrible pain, you know, in her lower quadrant. And my staff made it sound like she had an ectopic pregnancy. So I ran over there and I got a look at her medical records, and it was an ovarian cyst. So it wasn't a situation where I had to grab some friends of mine to get her out of there before she got, you know. And they said they were going to decide on Monday what to do. This is Friday. But they had told her that she had to have an operation, and they couldn't give it to her for free because she was not their patient, that she would have to pay for it. So we were over there Monday, and the doctor said she needed blood. This is why Andrew couldn't give blood this last time. And we got our friend Andrew, and he came over to give blood, and the doctor starts yelling at my director, saying, "Why are you giving her blood? She's just going to die in a day or two. What?" And Pip says, "Whether she lives or dies is not our business. It's our business that she needs the blood, and we have it." So she got the blood, and psychologically it was wonderful for her. And Pip went over in the morning early and saw her at about 8:30, 9 o'clock before doing other things. And she was walking around. And by noon she was dead. And then they went to chant for her in the mortuary, which we have repaired and take care of and chant in all the time. And there were two other bodies there. So they did 2 hours of chanting for all three of them. And as they were preparing to leave, a fourth body was brought in. Now, that hospital used to hold 60 AIDS patients. Now the AIDS beds are down to 30, and they're not always filled. And we've got 4 people dying in one day there. There are cards they gave the poor. These cards entitle you to free medical treatment. All right? and one of our staff members has one of those. But when she was having terrible problems and went to see her doctor for her regular AIDS medicine, the doctor didn't want to hear about it. We got her to another organization, and things got better. But the problem with those cards is the hospital is supposed to accept the card, bill a certain fund, and get reimbursed. It's like an insurance card for the desperately poor. The problem is there's no money in that fund. The cards are totally worthless, and nobody knows if there's ever going to be any money in that fund. Our job, our primary job, is emotional and spiritual Buddhist support in the face of whatever is going on. When we started working, there were no antiretrovirals. Most people didn't know what AIDS was, and everybody died. It hasn't gone back there yet. But it's gone back a real big distance in the last 8 months. And it hasn't stopped yet. Sorry.
There's nothing to be sorry about.
Well, this is hard to hear.
This is where gratitude comes in from our side.
Yeah.
Especially as you are able not only to embody and enact the Dharma, but that you can share it with us in this way that is real and grounded and gives us an opportunity not only to open our hearts to suffering, real suffering, but offering us an opportunity to help you and support you.
Well, thank you. But it's real important that while conditions are different, I mean, and this is a fundamental difference, I think, between Buddhism and Christianity. And it's an important one. Okay? In the wing of Christianity we're closest to, which is, you know, the one the Pope hates. Sorry. The liberation theology end. Yeah? They talk about an option for the poor. And Christ talks about the meek inheriting the earth. Okay? In Buddhism, there is no prioritization of suffering. You know? In Buddhism, whatever the suffering is, we work with it, and we work with it essentially in the same way. And the sufferings in America, you know, are inherently no different. I just work where it's easy to see because I'm kind of slow and stupid, and if it's in my face, I get it eventually. But to have gratitude that we've been given these lives, that we've been given fragile moments of beauty all the time, that we've been given a path that not only leads us out of personal involvement in, but to compassionate action. You know, we are tremendously, tremendously lucky that the Buddha decided to teach. You know? And he didn't just decide to teach because of AIDS in Cambodia. he decided to teach because of everything that's going on in every life in this room in exactly the same way. All right. Sorry. And you know, it's the first time for this talk, and it's a bit rocky, and I'm a bit rocky because I was really nuts about Vichette, man, and I just miss him so much, and I mind that I wasn't there with him. I'm jealous that I wasn't there with him to help him through that last period. Yeah. Because well, he had the courage, but his heart was not ready. And so now I just send as much metta as I can, so that before he enters rebirth again and goes into more of this, that his heart will be more ready. Because he was a person of terrific gifts. He was 5 when the Khmer Rouge took over and taken away from his parents. He was 10 when he was reunited with them. They managed to get him an education, which is extraordinary. And then he became an army and a soldier, and he was a soldier in one of the most dangerous areas in Cambodia for 20 years. You know. And he married this gorgeous woman, and they had 2 beautiful kids. And I don't know why he got into jail. He says it was a mistake, and we never ask how people get AIDS, and we never ask how people get into jail. Oh, want me to tell you a good story? Can I tell you a nice story? Sorry. One of our other bad boys that we know really, really well was horrible to his family before he was in prison. And a couple of years ago, he was dying. And we went to see his mother, who was in her 70s, 80s, and very weak. And she didn't want to hear about it. She didn't want us to come and tell her about it. She didn't want to know anything about it, right? And, you know, we sort of persisted, and every month or so we'd show up, and finally she let his sister go visit. And he did get better. And then in July, while we were on retreat, I get a phone call from him from the prison that his mother died. And I can't do anything because I'm, you know, 200 kilometers away on retreat, managing the retreat, right? And so I called the human rights organization to go see him. It turns out his mother hadn't died. She'd gotten really, 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 really sick, but she hadn't died. And we saw him, and he had shaved his head, which is what you do for respect for your parents and for people who... And so we went to see his mother because he wanted us to see how she was doing. And she was so impressed that he had shaved his head for her. So we very, very timidly broached the idea of her going to see him. Well, I don't have money to do. We'll take you. We'll take you in a... They have these little motorcycle-driven carriages that are reasonably comfortable. We'll take you. It's okay. And all of a sudden, she got real excited. So the next week, we took her. And we stopped along the way, and we got a ton of stuff. We got 12 huge baguettes. We got 6 or 7 pieces of cake with lots and lots of frosting. We got, I forget what else we got. But, you know, the guards are going to steal most of it, and we wanted him to have some left. So we get there, and Piet, my director, says, I'm not going, you go, because if you go, because I'm a foreigner and they know us, then we won't have to pay for the visit. You know, they just soak the relatives for these visits in ways you wouldn't believe. They just build a conjugal visit house, and for $100 a night, you can see your husband. This is in a country where $350 is the ordinary. The GDP is $350, and most people we know are well under that. Okay. Anyway, so I get there with the wife and with the mummy and the nephew, and they put us in the nice visiting place without any problems. And we sit there and we wait, and he comes in. And he takes off his shoes, and he kneels down, and he bows to his mommy 3 times. And he gets up, and he sits next to her, and they both start crying their eyes out. And 10 years got healed. And we got to see that. And we got to be part of that. Yeah. Sometimes it's really cool to have our job.
You know? Maybe that's a good place to stop.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a more cheerful place than what I've been telling you about. Okay. So thank everybody. It's always such a privilege to come here because the level of integrity and the level of commitment here are so pure. And Angie is such an amazing teacher. I want you to know I've invited her to Cambodia, so I would like you all to encourage her to come. Because the worst thing I did this year was have a really bad teacher for our retreat. And I owe my staff serious, 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 serious makeup. Cookies? Okay, closing ceremonies.
Thank you, Ben. Oh, thank you, Rumi. Thank you ever, ever so much.
Thank you. Thank you, all of you. You know, just... You know, I'm waiting for Angie to come and pick me up. And I'm feeling kind of fragile. And I think I'm going to get into Angie's car and I'm going to feel safe. And I think everybody in this room knows exactly what I mean, right? Yeah.